Bet, I want a snack. You want a Diet Coke from the corner store? She always did. I whisked up my jacket, stuffed the photo and the card inside a pocket. Opened the door and rode the elevator down 4 floors, taking in all the jittery, stuttering sounds of invisible machinery. On the ground floor, there was a clank and a bounce. Why tell Anne I hadn't been in contact with my mother in more than 8 months? Why tell her that? Outside the apartment, traffic crawled steadily over icy roads, exhaust and snow mixing in the air. The cold instantly tightened the skin on my cheeks, calmed me. After a moment, I circled back through the rotating door and stood in the warm foyer again, where the light was bright over the mailboxes. "Dear Maddie," Mr. Grierson wrote in his card. His cursive went loop, loop, loop. "Thank you for your letter a few months back," he loop said, slanting downward to the right. He went on. "What an unexpected thing. A real old-fashioned letter. I meant to write back right away, and then after some time passed, it seemed likely I would not write at all. But Christmas is a good excuse, and it was a nice surprise to hear from you. I guess because I didn't expect to get a letter like that. Hearing from an old teacher, I worry, can only be a disappointment. I remember running into one of my professors a few years back, and we just stood around with nothing to say. So I guessed that he didn't remember me the way he said he did, and was being nice. I vowed right there and then never to pretend to know an old student. What I'm saying is, please don't take it personally that my whole time in Minnesota is pretty much a blur to me now. I just don't have many memories of that year. Plus, I'm not as young as I was, as I'm sure you know. Even so, it's nice to know that someone got something out of my lessons. I did work hard, and it's good to feel that maybe all that work counted somehow. I'm running out of room on this card. Florida's nowhere I'd recommend. It's like being squashed slowly by invisible hands. Ha ha ha. It's hot is what I'm saying. The days go by pretty fast. And lately, I just want a shopping list approach to things. That's about all I feel capable of at this point. Here's what I want. Just sitting down at the end of the day and seeing that I can check off the items. I'm not in the least what you say I am. Though your letter was kind. I've learned a little about these things in my time. That is, the kinds of people who take the trouble to write me. I've found that some people who've done something bad will just go ahead and condemn everyone else around them to avoid feeling shitty themselves. As if that even works. Other types of people, and I'm not saying you're this necessarily, but I'm just putting it out there, will defend people like me on principle because when their turns come around, they want that so badly for themselves. My 2 cents, for what it's worth. California's awesome, though. Go, if you can. Peace, God bless, and Happy New Year. Adam Grierson. On New Year's Day, I got up early because I couldn't sleep, though I'd been out late the night before with Rom. I walked down the winding path that followed the Minnehaha Creek to Lake Nokomis. The sun never really rose. It was dark, and then it was just a little less so. When I got to the lake, I saw a hopeful fisherman pulling a red plastic sled of supplies across the ice. All the usual joggers and cross-country skiers had stayed home. They were sleeping in, I guess, doing their resolutions on note cards, drinking their bright orange mimosas, getting laid. It was me and the sled man, out in the world. His body made an acute angle with the ice. He was leaning that hard as he pulled. His sled had etched a long blue streak from one end of the lake to the other. When the wind started picking up, I hurried through the trees to keep warm, peed in a brittle porta-potty without fully sitting down, came out and left the lake behind, not looking back. Where did people in a city go to feel less trapped? On Cedar Avenue, I stopped for a cup of coffee to warm my bare hands at a bakery that sold so many kinds of bread, the loaves covered a whole wall. I stared at the bread for a while, then left without buying any. Instead, I went to a bar I'd come to like, where the stools were painted to look like human legs. I let myself get drunk. I let myself slouch, like the sled man, at a very acute angle over the bar. Eventually, I glanced at my watch and realized I needed to find a bus so I could meet Anne at our laundromat. Anne, who wanted to wash all our towels and rugs and curtains for the new year. Fresh start, she'd said. For 3 hours until my buzz wore off and our quarters drained, we washed and dried and folded our linens. By the time we started back, it was almost dark again. Anne said she wanted to see the rich people's luminaries along the river. So we walked with our baskets the long way home, through an alley and down a winding line of shops. Between a closed camera store and a bank, we passed a crow pecking at a frozen breadstick in front of a lonely lit shop. The shop had Science and Health marked in blue chalk in the window, and inside a Victorian lady with a brooch smiled placidly from a poster. The sidewalk crow hauled its breadstick up to a telephone wire, and as it did, Anne paused with her basket and lingered by the glass. She had gone to camp with some Christian Scientists years back, which made her think she was some kind of authority, and she stopped for a moment reading silently through the window. I thought they'd closed most of these reading rooms down. There's like hardly any churches left. Then she shook her head, shifting the weight of her basket from one hip to the other. I mean, the thing I never understood, the thing that doesn't make any sense, is how you can have a religion that offers absolutely no explanation for the origin of evil. I kept walking. It was another dreary, snowless night. Almost no one was out. We could have walked straight down the middle of the street. Where were those luminaries? I wondered. My arms were aching under the weight of our lemony-smelling towels. Had we gone too far, had we missed them? But no. Within a block, we caught sight of the first of several long lines of brown paper bags lit up, all flickering orangely with candles. Ah! Anne cried, stopping short, hipping her basket so she could touch my arm. Look at that! Look! At some point that year, maybe that night, maybe a few weeks later, I ended up telling Anne about Luce River. I told her about the competing nativity scenes at Christmas, the Lutheran sandbag Jesus and the Catholic's ice one. I told her about the gym roof that collapsed in eighth grade, and about Mr. Adler, who loved the Russian monarchs more than anything, even America. I may have even told Anne about my parents eventually, and about beautiful Lily. Lily, who left us to have her baby. But I never said a thing about Patra and Paul, and I never told her what I really thought about Christian Science, which is that, from what I know, from what little I know, it offers one of the best accounts of the origin of human evil. This is where it comes from, Anne. I think now that's the story I'm trying to tell here. When Paul was excited, he ran with big moon landing steps. He always looked as if he were concentrating very hard, saying to himself, "Run, run." And each time the word went through his head, he'd take a slightly more determined leap into the air. When I told him to run faster, he'd just run higher, and his pace would slow way down. He'd do all this useless work, hiking up his knees, pumping his fists. It was great to watch. And I was only a little cruel in provoking him. "Run!" I'd say. And he'd slow down to a near crawl, almost stopping between each stride. "Faster!" I'd say. His lips would pinch shut. He'd shunt one arm forward and one arm back. He was a kid who'd learned to run by watching dwarves in their mine, from TV, from cartoons. "Race you to the house," I said to him once, and, as if he'd finally figured it out, that day, at last, he'd stayed put on the dock. So I took a few exaggerated steps to encourage him. "I'm gonna beat you," I said, offering that irresistible threat, doing a thump, thump, thump with my boots on the planks. No dice. When I look back again, he'd slunk to a lying position, belly down, his arms curled up under him on the boards. "What's up?" I said. I closed in on him, casually prodded him with the toe of my boot.
This bear has gone into hibernation, looks like.
After a moment, I'm bored.
The bear is bored?
I asked, mock incredulous.
And...
He turned his neck so his face pressed into the boards, the skin of his lip pushing out in a loop.
My tummy...
Something about the way he said it made me crouch down and look at him more closely. Then I pulled him up to sitting. I lavished on him all I had in my little reserve.
Then you don't know about the wolf.
I don't want to pretend, he groaned.
This one's real, I promised.
This was late May, maybe. The aspens and poplars were dropping their seeds in fluffy drifts that accumulated, the way snow did, along the dirt driveway. I coaxed him into the garage with a few pretzels and buckled him in the bike while he ate them, slouched, helmeted, serenely disenchanted, looking big-headed and Buddha-like in his red plastic seat. I pulled the bike out onto the driveway and swung it a little menacingly when I climbed on. "Here we go!" I yelled, hoping to throw him off balance, hoping to thrill him into acting more like a kid. It was a long ride to the nature center, and the whole way there I told him wolf facts, wolf statistics, wolf stories. I intended to impress him with the taxidermy wolf in the lobby. I intended to point out the yellowed canines under her blue hooded lip, the cherry red drips of blood painted on her coral claws. I remembered the first time I'd seen that wolf as a kid. How the feeling went beyond love, how it made me hungry, hungry, hungry. But Paul had no interest in the wolf at all. He looked at it for a few seconds and shrugged. After 11 miles on the bike, all he had to say was, "That's not real." What he liked best at the center were puzzles. He found one on a shelf in the corner that exactly matched one he had at home. It was a bucolic winter woodland scene, a snowy owl, perched fatly on a black branch, eyes lidless and round as two open black pots. Paul knew how to put this puzzle together by heart, so instead of looking at the wolf or stuffed foxes, instead of fingering the rubber scat or dipping his little hand into one of the wooden boxes and guessing its contents, he sat cross-legged on the floor in the corner, piecing together the same puzzle he'd done dozens of times at home. I wandered around the center to kill time, read about the tea you could make from pine needles, watched goldfish circle Peg's aquarium. Eventually, nothing left to do. I went over and squatted next to Paul, who was holding a Swiss cheese slice of the owl's face in one hand. At first, it infuriated me that he didn't look up when I approached, that he didn't acknowledge me at all or wonder what I was doing. He scooched over, automatically let his body flow into mine and work its way onto my lap. He never stopped studying the puzzle. He settled his body against mine, arranging leg over leg, till I finally had to sit down fully on the floor. He assumed I was available and interested. He always just assumed. He bent double at the waist to reach the puzzle from the perch he'd taken on my lap and outside the window and down the road. Whole mountains of poplar fluff drifted past. At first I was annoyed, but then I was less so. I felt his chest expand with each breath against his nylon jacket and against my ribs. I felt the heat of his body through my jeans. He moved his fingers very knowingly from piece to piece, leaning his head back into me occasionally to assess. When he finished, he broke the puzzle up to do it again. "Nope," I said, though I wasn't sure I meant it. By then, the room was going golden in the early evening sun. It was something I thought I should say, though. "It's time to go." That's when he yawned, his skull stoppering up the breath between my clavicles. There was something about that made me regret suggesting we leave. Something about the simple gift of his body, its closeness, and its heat, that made me want to stay a little longer. Then we were at the door. Me zipping his jacket up, Peg handing him 3 gummy bears. Then I asked him proddingly for Peg, "Did you have a nice time?" He nodded in a way that moved his whole body up and down. "That was a great puzzle," he said. Chapter 16. According to her testimony, Patra grew up in a subdivision outside Milwaukee. She was the youngest of 5 children by almost a decade, raised in a household of adults. Her father was an engineer, and her mother, who'd stayed home with all her siblings, had gone back to school by the time Patra was born, and was getting a PhD in urban sociology. She had taken little Patra to all the classes she TA'd, and to her field research in a juvenile center in Waukesha. By the time Patra was in high school, her mother was a tenured faculty member. Her father had died of colon cancer, and her siblings had teenage children of their own. Patra finished high school a year early and left for the University of Chicago, where she met Dr. Leonard Gardner her junior year. The week she graduated, they were married. He bought a turn-of-the-century colonial for them in Oak Park, and a vegetable garden and cats, a swing set, a gazebo. After Paul was born, Patra took him to infant music classes, then gymnastics for toddlers. She started him in preschool when he was 3, one of the best in town. She'd driven him to Montessori classes every day. Patra confirmed this on the stand, even though she didn't like to drive, and even though she'd have preferred to keep him home with her a little longer. Patra also confirmed when the DA pressed her that when Paul's teacher had expressed concern one day in February about his health, she'd taken him secretly to see her mother's friend, who was a pediatric endocrinologist. The DA showed paperwork disclosing the doctor-ordered tests that Patra never scheduled. Patra tried to explain that this was because Paul had seemed better after that, so she blamed her worry and her decision to see the doctor on over-concern with the natural fluctuations of a growing child. She was getting herself worked up, she said, losing a sense of perspective. It was around this point that she agreed to Leo's plan to spend some time at their newly built summer house in March. "To give us some mental space," she said. "To have a change of scenery." I also learned during the trial that while I'd been in Loose River that day getting Tylenol, while I was on my way to and from town, Leo had decided it would be best to get a change of scenery again. He'd worked an unconscious Paul into a pair of pants, wedged his feet in shoes, filled his backpack with puzzles and trains, handy wipes and animal crackers, a coloring book of birds he'd bought in Duluth. He'd combed down Paul's hair. And when I returned with the bottle of pills in the afternoon, there they were on their way out the door through the kitchen. Patra came first and walked right past me, her face white and taut. Then Leo. Then Paul in Leo's arms, Leo sidestepping the kitchen island like he was carrying a big bundle of wood or a miniature bride. Leo's red eyes took me in, then moved on to other obstacles in his path. The table, the front door. "Thanks, Linda," he said, when I moved a chair out of the way for him. Paul's one white arm dangled behind him like a length of rope. "Did they tell you where they were going?" I was asked. "They didn't say anything. Did they tell you they would drive 2.5 hours and make 2 stops at private residences in both Brainerd and St. Cloud?" "They didn't say. Neither of them, medical professionals, before the victim expired from complications of cerebral edema at approximately 7:30 that night?" Leo just asked me to lock up behind them. The last I saw of Patra, she was standing in the driveway, bent over double, the heel of her hand in her mouth like a hunk of bread. She had on unbuttoned jeans and slouchy moccasins. And when she straightened up, her whole face was slick. Her eyes were unfocused, her mouth open wider than it needed to be for breathing. She closed the car door without a word. I stood in the doorway for a long time after they left. I still had the bottle of pills in my hand, and after a while I went back inside and set it down on the table. I didn't take my shoes off at the door. I could see tiny half-moons of dirt in a track I'd made across the floor. Back on the mat, I untied my tennis shoes and found a broom for the dirt, sweeping in my socks through the kitchen and down the hall. Outside Paul's bedroom, there was a fishy sweet scent. I stood for a moment holding my breath. Then I went in and lifted Paul's full plate of pancakes from the dresser, gripped his full glass of milk, which looked viscous in my hand, and carried both back to the kitchen. I walked out to the deck and poached some pine cones and strips of bark from Europa's walls, carried them back in my arms, arranged them just as they'd been outside, right there on Paul's rug, in a half circle around the dresser. The room smelled better then, like sap. I heaved open the window for good measure. Someone had already stripped the bed. I folded the Candyland board, returned it to its box. I turned on Paul's caboose nightlight, though it wasn't dark. Though the late afternoon sun had hit an angle that allowed it to filter through the trees and shove a trapezoid of light across the floor. I sat on his little kid bed, lay back, willed my skin not to crawl when I felt the dampness of his bare mattress. I focused on the trapezoid of light as it bent in half, made a stage, then seeped up the wall. My feet in their socks dangled off the far edge of the bed. "You thought they'd come back?" The room began to darken. I could hear the clock ticking, a gutter creaking, the refrigerator humming. A loon called out twice, slicing at the evening, cutting all excess away. "This is this," it said. "That is that." A breeze shook the blinds. I didn't notice when the trapezoid of light disappeared. I didn't notice it was night until I heard a gravelly throat clear from the doorway. I sat up. In the red glow of Paul's nightlight, I saw a man's silhouette. My first thought was that it was Leo, come back. I thought it was Leo, and a feeling of dread or relief or both went through me. It wasn't Leo, though. It was my dad. "Your mom sent me," he said. "I knocked." He must have come through the unlocked door, come hunting through the empty house while I'd been sleeping. Had I been sleeping? He looked at me sitting in Paul's bed, sitting guiltily, must, like some teenage Goldilocks in droopy socks and a sweaty t-shirt. "Madeline?" he asked. I saw the room the way it must have looked to him. Red night light in the corner. Pine cones circling the dresser, bunnies and bears on the shelves overhead, and me all by myself in bed, as if I'd made an elaborate fort in the woods or something, as if I'd made everything up and he'd walked in on me playing dolls or pretend. For a second I felt like the littlest of little kids. I scooted to the edge of the bed, hooked my heels on the baseboard.
"Wouldn't have come in," he apologized, "but I saw your tennis shoes by the door."
He was wearing a shirt, I'd worn myself, a soft gray flannel that was tight across his chest, but that had hung from my shoulders when I'd worn it to school last spring. His gray ponytail was threaded through the back of his twins cap as usual. He was blinking his eyes to adjust to the light.
"Everything okay?"
Maybe I was wrong to think that there was only one answer to that question that would keep me from walking straight over and setting my face against his chest. "Yep."
"Your friend's family? They..."
I could see how much it cost him to say even that much. Hadn't he always made it seem a great kindness? The greatest kindness of all. Not to ask too many questions. Wasn't that something I'd always known? Hadn't he taught me that much? "They just left. I'm on my way home now." If that was overtly false, he didn't challenge me.
Okay,
was all he said, setting his big palm over his mouth again, rubbing away whatever remains of an expression might have been there. Then he turned and headed out, me behind him. He passed on about a decade after that. Two strokes in his last months made his face look softer, fatter. He became almost a fat man in the end, overnight it seemed. Though he must have been gaining weight for years, slowly, as he walked less and drove his ATV more, as he stopped canoeing any farther than across the lake. I came home once that last year to help my mom winterize the place, and I saw that someone had hung a bird feeder from one of the front pines. All day long, Dad watched birds come and go. I remember sitting with them one violet evening, as the sun went down, watching birds congregate in the snow outside. At some point, I lifted my hand and said, "Look, a nuthatch." I knew immediately I was wrong. The house finch hopped to a branch and shat. I knew he knew as well, and even so, he nodded. That's the kind of person my dad was. Here's what my mom was like. That same winter, as I stood on a stool tacking quilts over the window, as the birds fought for seed outside, and my dad slept in his chair, she went on and on about my father as a young man. "He would have followed me anywhere," she said, not bothering to whisper. "He didn't know if he wanted to start school or go to work for his daddy or go fishing. He just didn't know. He was turning circles, going nowhere. I knew what he should do." She rested her elbows on an unfinished project on the kitchen table, open books on top of other open books. She was more restless that winter than usual. She stood up for more coffee, but her mug was still full. "He needed direction," she said, sitting down, rimming her mug with a finger. "You wouldn't know it from the way he was later, but he was just one of those guitar-strumming kids at the time. Back then, all he could do was pick a tune and catch a fish. That's it. He picked up everything else later." It was 1982 when they set out, she told me, nobody's idea of a revolutionary time. They were eight adults altogether, plus three half-grown kids. Because my mother was older than the rest, because they were good with talk and she was good with plans, she'd been the one who'd arranged the timing of the departure, assigned jobs to the others, convinced my dad to lift a few axes and rifles from a bait and tackle shop. "You understand?" my mother asked me. I didn't answer. I'd heard most of these stories before. I'd heard her describe that first winter in the cabin many times when I was young, all the scrappy little crises, the one fish they had to eat, the two new babies that came before spring, the ex-nutritionist's kid who'd set one of the babies on fire by accident one night, and the frantic drive to the hospital in a storm, the broken-down van on the road, the baby who was fine after all, and the kid-turned-teenager who wouldn't speak again after that. I'd heard the stories, but never quite like this, never with this mix of bitterness and nostalgia. Before, she'd always emphasized how young they'd been then, how ignorant and misguided. But she hadn't been young, she told me now. She was 33, long past her high school and college years. Everything she did when she should have known better. "Listen," she told me. And she went through it all again from the very beginning. The van stolen from her parents' garage in the middle of the night, the perilous winter drive to her uncle's abandoned fishing cabin, the big new bunkhouse they'd built the first spring, the relief of summer and summer again, the commune charter they'd copied in calligraphy on parchment and hung over the door, but then set on fire when everything fell apart 6 years in. It was pretty bad at the end, sure. Everybody fighting everyone else, everyone jealous and getting confused about the kids, what to do with you guys. But not all the parts were bad, not most of the time. We had good ideas, good plans. We wanted kinship, not obligations. She paused. We believed there should be more than the nuclear family. We really
thought we could see something better.
She glanced at my sleeping dad, his cheek smashed against his shoulder. She went on.
We really thought we could do more with the world.
I looked down at her from my stool and waited.
But then everyone took off, and we started over with just you.
Chapter 17. P.S. The sequoias are more impressive than the other redwoods, in case you ever get out to California. There's a difference, just so you know. The coastal redwoods grow, obviously, on the coast, and the sequoias are in the mountains. You can drive straight through a sequoia, right? That's one of the things people do. Plus, the sequoias are older. I thought you'd appreciate knowing the difference. I used to go camping in the Sierra Nevada with my dad, and we'd eat canned soup and sleep in this tiny two-man tent he had from the army. It was great. Those trees really do seem permanent. They're so big. We stayed for weeks, never washed our hair, drank Tang. The woods look like the time of dinosaurs or something. Of course, things always seem more impressive when you're a little kid. That's one of the reasons I don't really want to go back. I mean, who wants to ruin one of the things you like thinking about most? Who gives that up on purpose? Thank goodness for the back of the card, but now I'm really out of room. Bye again, Mr. G. Chapter 18. The summer passed quickly after the gardeners left. Or not quickly, but in fragments. It was one of the hottest summers in a while. It was so hot some nights in July that I soaked my t-shirt in lake water before going to sleep. I wrung it out in the woods and wore it dripping through the dark house and up my ladder. Mornings, the sun coaxed steam off the lake, and it was too humid in the afternoons to do anything at all. I remember waiting out the worst hours in some flickering patch of shade beneath the pines, brushing away flies with a fir branch, searching for ticks on the dogs, all four, who lay collapsed around me in the dust. Working my fingers through Abe's thick, half-husky fur, I could feel each of his ribs in turn, convulsing as he panted. I could feel the way the bones separated and contracted again, making room for more oxygen. I could feel him scooching away, patiently, from the unfamiliar heaviness of my hand. I remember bouncing one humid evening on the back of my dad's ATV to the police station in Whitewood, where they gave me a Coke poured so fast into a styrofoam cup it overflowed on the table. This was a few days after an officer showed up at the bottom of the Sumac Trail and spoke with my dad over the hood of his black and white car. At the police station, they handed me a roll of brown paper towels to wipe the spilled Coke. They offered to get me another can, but I shook my head and sucked the froth from the top. Someone turned on a fan that blew warm air into my face, and as it dried out, my nose and eyes. I remember wondering if this was where Lily had come. If this was where she'd sat last spring and had a Coke and said her piece against Mr. Grierson. I never knew for sure. I spent hours in that one little room that summer, in a green plastic lawn chair, answering questions from different people in uniforms and suits. I no longer remember who asked what, or when, or in what order. I know I drank lots of warm Coke. I chewed lots of lips off of the smallish styrofoam cups meant for coffee. I sprinkled the chewed white bits across the table like clumpy snow. And eventually I learned to ask for the one cushioned folding chair they had, which was kept behind the front desk. By late July, I'd been prepped by a lady with a pouty face, the DA's assistant, to cross my legs at the ankle and fold my hands, and if I remembered, to say ma'am to the judge and sir to the defense lawyer. Don't let him scare you now, she told me. Don't bite your nails like that. Don't look down. Don't let it get to you. Think of yourself as floating or something, like a fish. You like to fish, don't you? But not a dead fish. I don't mean float like that. I mean swimming in the water. Get that image in your mind. Remember, you're not the one on trial.
I wasn't scared, though.
I didn't need to think of myself as a walleye drifting along in a current somewhere, just waiting for my hook.
I was yearning for it.
August came. The days grew hazier, ash-scented. Forest fires were going strong a few lakes north of us, and the air tasted of it, though the worst of the blaze was more than 50 miles away. "Safe by the skin of our teeth," people were saying. By then, by the end of summer, all the deciduous trees, all the aspens and birch, had gone crinkly and blonde in the hot weather. The pink geraniums in the window boxes of the Whitewood County District Courthouse lay slung over, and the grass along the front walk was brown in strips, brown except for a square of emerald sod laid down against the marble steps, like a tiny, pricey carpet. For weeks, the heat had been oppressive. But now that summer was ending, now that September was on the horizon and the first geese were in flight, everyone was going on about how perfect the season had been, how lucky we'd been all along, how blessed to live in the north in the woods, which was God's own country. "What a doozy of a day," I heard, as my mom and I filed up the marble steps to the courthouse. "What a perfect 10, was the reply, though it was 90 degrees already. Inside, I had to listen to the same conversation about the weather again and again. I watched the DA's assistant flick a finger in a glass of water and dampen her lips as she spoke to a man who was painstakingly rolling up one of his sleeves, inch by inch by inch. I watched them eyeing me in my thrift store dress, assessing me, and at the same time pretending they weren't. When I glared back, they pinched their eyes into smiles, looked at their watches, crossed their legs. Beside me, my mom sat too close on the gallery bench, sweating and fanning herself with one limp hand. My dad had decided not to come. He'd said he was afraid that a shift in the wind would bring the fires closer, and though I'd hoped for more from him, I knew better than to question this or ask him to reconsider. Someone shoved open a window at the back of the courtroom and a breeze trickled in, but it wasn't enough. At one point, my mom put her damp hand on my arm. "Oh, my, oh, my," she said. So, I followed her gaze. Leo and Patra came in, single file. Patra's hair had grown out, I saw, as they walked past. It no longer frizzed up around her ears, but hung gelled with product over her sweatered shoulders. She was wearing a baby blue cardigan, and already, even before she got on the stand, navy crescents of sweat bloomed under each armpit. I expected her to look over at me and give me a sign, a wave across the stuffy courtroom, a hello or a nod, or, if she couldn't manage that, I thought I could understand. I'd take a glance in my direction, any indication at all that she saw me. But every time I looked her way, her eyes went somewhere else. She was whispering something in Leo's ear or examining the bracelet on her wrist. She took a sip of water from a bottle on the table where she sat. One knee jiggled under her black silk skirt, but her face was as calm as I'd ever seen it. On the stand, she kept her eyes down most of the time, her hands folded in her lap. When her lawyer asked about her childhood, she answered in paragraphs, back straight. She responded to the district attorney's questions when he addressed her with such precision, such mildness, that she might have been discussing weather, too, but with a touch more regret than everyone else in the room, perhaps even condescension. That's what the DA wanted the jury, to resent her for most, I understood from my pretrial prep, her blitheness and her youth, her professor husband. He implied that these things made Patra the worst combination of snobbish and debased. "Speak up," the DA said once, when she folded a tissue to blow her nose. And she replied, with what might have been fear but also might have been contempt, "I did not say anything." It went on like that, the DA asking her to clarify or speak up, and Patra repeating herself in a small, breathy voice. She never once said my name, or Paul's. She said the babysitter. She said, "My son, whom I love." As she murmured her mild answers, I thought I could imagine the schoolteacher Patra might have been. The editor in her, checking every word with her neat red pen. I could hear the grammar in her sentences. I could hear all her minute corrections. "My son, whom I love so much, told me he was feeling better. We were relieved, overjoyed. We could not have been happier." She sat up straighter and straighter as she spoke, and her neck seemed longer. In a short time, the blue fabric under her arms was nearly black.
"I'm trying to understand, Mrs. Gardner, I am."
The DA put his hand to his chest so that his tie squished up a little under his chin.
"You're saying you didn't see that something was wrong? Or that you did and failed to seek treatment? It can only be one or the other. Please help us understand."
I watched Patra swallow. "He was being treated."
"Yes, fine, your husband explained yesterday. We're all for prayer. We're not here to put anyone's religion on trial, but I need you to clarify something for us. The morning you were in Duluth, that is, the morning of June 20th, didn't you tell your husband you were taking Paul to the store for, what was it, picnic supplies? When, in fact, you placed a call to the pediatrician you'd contacted months before, Dr. The quickest of glances at Leo.
"No one was there."
"But you thought something was wrong. You understood at that point something was wrong."
A swallow, the whole mechanism of her throat moving. "There was never a diagnosis."
"Why was that?"
"People go to doctors all the time." For the first time all day, I could hear the pleading in her voice. I could hear how much she wanted to convince him of this, or at least make him be nicer to her. She put her white hands on the railing in front of her. "Don't people go to doctors all the time? And they don't always get better."
"Excuse me, Mrs. Gardner, you're changing the subject. Please don't make me remind you again to answer the question that's been asked. We've already heard that insulin and fluids might have saved him up to 2 hours before he suffered cardiac arrest. 2 hours! The treatment is minimal and simple."
"I'm his mother," Patra interrupted.
"You were his mother," the DA interrupted back.
Something rushed into her face, then flowed out again like water. All the muscles in her face clenched, then let go. After that, she waited patiently for the next question, eyes flat as two tiny blue screens. She repeated the same things she'd said before. He was fine. He was resting in bed. And when the DA dismissed her at last, frustrated, she moved across the courtroom with her TV eyes, holding her bottle of water upside down in both hands, like a throttle. That whole morning, I kept waiting for her to look up at me, so I could reassure her somehow. All I needed was the smallest sign from her, and I would have laid it all on Leo when my time came around. There he sat with his back to me, a Bible on his lap and a full bottle of water, nodding ever so subtly at Patra. He shifted in his seat when she sat down, recrossed his legs so his knee nudged hers. He'd grown a beard since I'd seen him last, one trimmed so close it was a half mask of gray. I watched, but he didn't poke out his cheek with his tongue. He didn't look upset. He didn't look at all worried.
"It's going to be okay,"
he'd said to me that last day after he'd loaded Paul in the car. I'd been standing stupidly on their front stair. Patra was hunched in the back seat and Leo was circling around the hood when he saw me wavering in their open doorway. He'd paused then, walked back across the driveway. "It's going to be okay," he'd said, hands coming at me through the air. He'd taken the time to reach out and hug me, saying,
"You can't be anything but good. Got that, Linda? You shouldn't feel bad about any of this."
Still, I would have accused him of bullying, of making us do his bidding. But Patra never gave me a sign. In the break before I was to take the stand, I went outside and smoked 3 cigarettes as fast as I could. I sat on the parking lot curb, and when the cigarettes were gone, I put my arms on my knees and my head on my arms, closed my eyes. My heart felt like a black train chugging uphill through my body. I let the heat of the sun rise from the concrete and cook my skin. And when I opened my eyes, the dazzling white of the day emptied me out. A chainsaw buzzed in the distance. I heard branches splintering down. Then, in a gust of hot wind, Patra came out. She pushed open the courthouse door and stood for a moment, taking in deep breaths. The wind blew her hair, so she looked a little more herself, a little less combed. She uncapped her water bottle and sucked the water down, sucked so hard the plastic collapsed. And when she pulled her mouth away, the bottle popped. I guess she didn't see me, crouched on the curb between cars, because when she lifted the bottle to her mouth again, tilting back her head, she walked a few steps closer. She came close enough for me to catch a whiff of her coconut shampoo, close enough almost to reach out and touch her black nylon leg. I could have left it like that. It felt like the sign I'd been hoping for, just her leg and a big drop of water falling from her mouth and graying the concrete. 37, 26, 15, I thought, watching another drip come down. 26, 15, 4. I stood up the second before she turned. Here's what her face did then. A mutant half-smile formed on her lips, habitual friendliness mixed with undeniable loathing. "I have nothing to say to you. Please." It sounded like a lawyer's line to me. She turned away. "Patra."
"What?"
She turned back and her question seemed in earnest now.
"What?"
"I... listen." A muscle fluttered in her neck.
"I hate him," I blurted. "Leo."
"I hate him for you," I meant.
"Leo?"
She seemed confused. Another gust of wind had tossed hair in her eyes, and she pushed it back. As she did, as she palmed her hairline, I saw her freckles were disappearing in the red of her skin. Something new was turning in her eyes.
"Leo?"
she asked again, her voice dripping, soaked to the bone.
"Paul was just..."
I whispered, more hesitant now.
"It wasn't your fault." "What are you saying to me?"
She took a step forward. I put my hand on her arm to calm her, and she started back as if stricken. She gave a peculiar shiver, and I saw then that I was just a part of the evil that took him. The one who arrived just in time for and presided over his disappearance. That's all I was to her now. She bit out at me.
"You're the one who thought of him that way. You're the one who looked at him and saw," she sobbed, "a sick little boy."
"No,
I know you did. And that's all you could see, isn't it? Isn't it?"
I
should have gone earlier, I admitted. It was the only time I ever said it. I should have gotten help for us. Us. We needed it. How could he get better with you thinking like that? She spat. How could he? I've thought about this. I've gone over and over it. Leo told me, control your thoughts, but it was your mind. She said it like she could barely get the words out. Your mind. That was too small. To see beyond itself. She drew a ragged breath. Yours. You saw him as sick. They'd made me wear my hair differently that day. Combed and parted on one side, clipped with a single barrette. It kept getting in my face, so I had to hold it gathered in one fist, my bent arm across my chest. They insisted I wear a long, loose dress with a salad-y green floral pattern. I could feel my sweaty thighs slip against each other beneath the fabric. I could feel my cotton underwear droop down my butt. Damp. I smelled like mothballs, cigarettes, and laundry detergent. I felt hideous, ridiculous. The local teenager, I was called by the defense attorney, and the North Star Gazette. Babysitter, Patra said on the stand. So, when she said what she did in the parking lot, I hunkered down and refused to say anything more. She didn't need or want a response. She screwed the lid back on her water bottle and turned around. After she left, I stayed in the parking lot until a bailiff, or someone, my mom, came to get me. I stood in the sun, which made my skin itch, and made my face feel rigid and thick like it was stretched over my eyes, making it hard to see. I stood there and listened to the chainsaw as it brought down someone's bad tree. First the swishy leafy parts, then the clattering branch work, and finally the trunk in a thump. Nobody believes you when you talk about happiness, Patra told me once. For months I'd watched her blow into Paul's soup and kiss his perfect half-moon eyebrows. I'd watched her rush out in the rain before dinner, gather up books he had left by the lake, come back in, dripping, elated, run around the house, rubbing her hands, trying to warm up again, sing to him, sing to us. I'd watched her slide in her socks from one side of the kitchen to the other, from counter to island, filling plates, stirring pots, pushing the frizz of her hair from her face with her hands, and all that time, Paul had been fine. He was fine. He was better than that, even. Hadn't Patra broken granola bars into bits to look like kibble so he could eat like cats? Hadn't she warmed his apple juice in the microwave once because he said it was too cold, it hurt his teeth? He was so entirely and evidently cherished. That's the truth. I could have said all that when I had my chance. I wanted to. I planned on it. But didn't. Here's what I said on the stand when I was asked what Patra had done for her son. Nothing. She did nothing. Chapter 19. I remember there was this big faded mural in the courthouse hallway. It showed an Indian with a white guy in a canoe, both in chocolatey furs, both pointing into the woods at a bear on the shore. There were green trees and white fluffy clouds, everything nice and peaceful, you know, everybody getting along. But as I was leaving the courthouse that day with my mom as we were walking out, I noticed the perspective on the mural in the hallway was a little off. The white guy was actually pointing at the bear's butt, and the Indian had a pointing arm, but not another one.
and the bear appeared to be levitating slightly. His paws were not quite on the ground, and he looked unsurprised to be floating off into the trees like that, bored and resigned to it, maybe. And also sort of terrifying. I didn't know whether to push or pull the door. Couldn't find the handle at first. "Are you coming?" my mother asked as I floated outside. Somehow I found my way down the marble steps. Somehow I got myself and my dress back in the hot truck. And we were on the road again. The pickup was on loan from a church acquaintance of my mother's, someone who'd heard about the trial and wanted to show the difference between true Christians and false ones. It had Mr. Yuck stickers in a line across the dashboard, a dentist office smell from the air freshener that spun from the rearview mirror. My mother could only get her window crank to work by leaning into it with her whole body, and even then she could only slide the glass down a crack. She focused exclusively on shifting gears in the busy streets near downtown. She had recently renewed her license and was a conscientious stopper at all the signs, a silent and focused merger onto the highway. But then, when we hit the easy flat of Route 10, when the traffic vanished and woods returned, she started easing her way from subject to subject. The heat, the judge's drawl, the yellow toilet in the ladies' room, Mrs. Gardner's sweater. She didn't know why anyone would wear a sweater in August. It bothered her for some reason. She kept glancing at me as she spoke, fishing for strands of her hair that had blown out the window crack. I mean, who would wake up and think, "Hey, it's 90 degrees, I should go get my cardigan"? She looked at me across the cab where I was sort of slumped against the far door. "Earth to Madeline," she said. "Earth to me, earth to me," I thought. I was watching the way shadows and sun curtained the black road in front of us, the way their movement seemed to make the pavement undulate as we drove over it. I was wondering if the highway tar on the shoulder was actually melting or just seeming to melt, if the little rodents and insects scrambling across would get stuck in the mess, if it was a dangerous place for them to be. I was mentally warning them all away, the toads and the grasshoppers, and even as I was doing that, even as I was creating a force field on both sides of the highway with my mind, I could sense the appeal in my mother's glance, the way it was almost physically painful for her to have to endure my silence now. "Hello," she said, after a moment pretending to knock the air between us with her free hand. "Is the teenager sleeping?" I set my head against the window. "I'm just saying it was an impractical thing to wear." "It was impractical, wasn't it?" She was kneading the steering wheel with her hands. She was looking at me long enough for the truck to swerve slightly into the oncoming lane. "Just say yes, okay?" She got the truck back on course. She slowed down. Or maybe the engine missed. "Just say yes. That sweater was a strange thing to wear. You can add fucking. You're a teenager, so I don't care. Say it was a fucking ridiculous thing to wear. And then you can say that her explanation, her defense, or whatever that was pretty much a load of bull, too." I could hear the gumming of her palms against the plastic of the wheel. Then she added, getting worried, "You know it's a load of bull, right?" When I was 11 or 12, I found this unexpected thing in the back of the shed. It was a wooden cradle wrapped in a clear plastic tarp, which I pulled open when I was looking for something else. The thing was hand-painted with white daisies and blue lilacs, long-finned fish swimming through it all like golden grinning devils. It was filled to the brim with rotting firewood, mouse droppings, unfurling weevils. I remember covering it back up with the tarp, finding a stack of asphalt shingles to lay over it. I shooed the dogs outside and went back to my day, but later, when I was guiding the canoe through shallows, or pulling some teeny thorns from Abe's paw, or working out a tedious math problem, The image of that cradle,